The Kickoff with Steve Hothersall.
Rock, sport and talk.
Radio City Talk.
Right, what was the last World Cup that you really enjoyed, that you were compelled to watch? You felt the players were part of you and every kick of the ball and every emotion you felt. A lot of people would say 1990 in Italia. Italia 1990, World in Motion and all that. And that's the name of a brand new book which has been written by Simon Hart, which goes deep into the tournament. All sorts of social commentary on what was going on around different countries at the time. And, of course, the footballers involved. So whether it be your Roger Millers, your Jurgen Klinsmanns, your Paddy Bonners. Remember, Ireland were there. So let's talk more about it with Simon. Hello, Simon.
Hi, Steve.
Is it the World Cup? Is it the defining World Cup for you? You're 45 years old.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think anybody who was, you know, a teenager or experiencing their first World Cup then, it left a big mark. It left a huge mark on English football. And as, you know, as I discovered when doing the book, it left a huge mark, you know, in many countries around the world.
Was it the last great World Cup as far as England are concerned?
Well, there's not been too many to choose from. I mean, it's the only World Cup where England have been to a semi-final, you know, on foreign soil. It was the last World Cup before, you know, I suppose football's big bang, you know, with the satellite age of the game, with the Premier League, the Champions League. So it was the last World Cup where, I suppose, it was an incredible voyage of discovery where you don't know who these players are. One stat I kind of dug up for it was that there are only two players in that World Cup, foreign players who were playing in our English top flight, who were Roland Nielsen, Chaffee Wednesday, Glenn Hussein at Liverpool.
That's remarkable. And would you know the stats now for this current year?
I don't know for this current year. I know that obviously for the last World Cup in Brazil, the Premier League contributed the most players, you know, of any national league. So many of these players are familiar to us now, whereas, you know, then, you know, who on earth was Cyril Macanaki? You know, who's this Scalacci bloke for Italy? You know, these were all, you know, people we were discovering in that moment in time.
Roger Miller being another name in case. And yet now we actually refer to them as legendary figures.
No, indeed. If you mention Roger Miller, you know, another example of you know, just these people appearing from nowhere to write these, you know, stories which excite us. I think Senegal beat France in the opening game in the 2002 World Cup, and every single member of that Senegal starting 11 was playing their club football in France. So the whole of France knew who these were, and, you know, most of us would have seen them on satellite TV, whereas in Italia 90... Only five of that team played in European football in top five leagues, and for Cameroon they'd only had television broadcast for 5 years. So for them it was their first ever World Cup they could switch on and watch. So everything was, I guess, a bit more exciting and magnified then by the novelty of it.
If you had to take a handful of teams from the 1990 World Cup and say that these are the teams that define this World Cup, obviously Cameroon would be one, because they sent shockwaves around the world for what they were doing, the football they were playing, the figures that were involved. Obviously West Germany, because of what went on to happen, England and Gaza. Who else would you involved in that?
I think every good story needs a baddie. So Argentina would be definitely in there as well, because if you remember, Maradona was the hate figure of that World Cup. He just won the league with Napoli. And, of course, the whole of northern Italy hated Naples. So Maradona was booed in every stadium the Argentina played in. Apart from Naples, and, you know, just to underline the drama of this World Cup as well, I mean, it might have been the lowest scoring World Cup, but it was also, you know, incredibly dramatic. The fact that Maradona and Argentina play Italy in the semi-final in Naples, you know, just, it was the perfect setting for...
Write that one, could you?
Not, at least not, you know, for the Italian nightmare that unfolded that night. But so I'd have Argentina in there as well. We're looking for one more country. The Irish would want themselves in there, of course.
But there's a bizarre story about Ireland, isn't there? And, you know, England played them in the group stages, which is often forgotten on these shores. but never over in Ireland, as you discovered during interviewing several people in here.
No, you're right. I mean, we forget. I mean, we talk about what Italian 90 means to us. I mean, for Ireland, it was such a massive thing. I mean, I think nearly 500,000 people turned out on the streets of Dublin to welcome them back. And Tony Cascarino laughed when he mentioned to me that, you know, we came back as the biggest, you know, Irish sporting heroes of all time, and yet they didn't actually win a single game, technically. you know, they drew all of their group games, then they, you know, they beat Romania on penalties and lost to Italy in the quarterfinals. But going back, you mentioned the England-Ireland game. It was played in, you know, in rain, in Cagliari, in Sardinia. It was an absolutely dreadful game of football. Afterwards, you know, one of the Italian papers said, "No football, please. We're British," as their headline, because it was that bad. One of the English players one of the English newspapers was imploring Margaret Thatcher to bring the team home at this point, you know, to spare us any further embarrassment. So it was. We forget. You know, we remember the kind of the glorious failure of Turin and Paul Gascoigne crying, but you know, it was a really, you know, depressing start to that World Cup for England.
It's worth putting a bit of colour on England, because heading into Italia 90, of course, they lost all three matches at the European Championships in 88. And just weeks ahead of Italia 90, there's all sorts of back page headlines saying, get rid of Bobby Robson. He's just not good enough for this job.
Yeah, I mean, Robson nearly left after you mentioned the Euro in 88. He nearly left then. Leading up to the World Cup, he hadn't been offered a contract renewal by the FA. So quite reasonably, you know, now with hindsight, he accepted a contract offer from PSV Eindhoven, at which point, you know, he had so much abuse from the tabloid press here. You know, he was seen as this traitor, you know, simply because of the fact he'd secured his future after the World Cup. And on top of that, there was a circulation war going on with, you know, with the English tabloid, the Red Tops. So basically, the players stopped talking to the papers because there was a story about some of the players being involved with a hostess over in Sardinia. There was this kind of radio silence from the team. The manager, who the press have abused,
it turned against,
and this appalling, you know, opening game in the rain in Sardinia against the Irish, but suddenly out of nowhere, you know, there's a flourishing of English football, and it was Gazza who led that. They played Holland in the second game, and Gazza did, you know, there's a famous shot of him doing a Cruyff turn on Ronald Koeman. You know, if again, more context, English football, we've been, you know, in exile for 5 years after, you know, the Heysel ban. We have a dreadful Euro when our fans are the story. You know, there were, you know, almost 400 arrests in Dusseldorf. So the whole narrative of that World Cup was meant to be about our fans and our manager and the fact we've got a team who aren't very good. And suddenly Gazza's there, tugging at Rud Hullett's dreadlocks, Cruyff turning Ronald Koeman, and you think maybe there is hope after all.
Which makes the story even better. World in Motion is the book. We're going to pick out the West Germany game as a match of my life and talk about that in a little bit of depth with Simon Hart, the author of this book.
Match of my life. Life stories and greatest games.
Radio City Talk.
Italia 90, the inside story. World in Motion is a new book by Simon Hart. World in Motion, which means one thing to an awful lot of people. You've explored an awful lot of elements of the World Cup in the book, including the song. The song means so much to so many people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, New Order, World in Motion, which was New Order's only number one, actually. But yeah, that was just a World Cup song that, this, you know, stands out, because if everything else really before that had been pretty tacky. You know, players, all of them lined up in tracksuits singing something pretty cheesy, and suddenly you had a New Order song, which was such a departure, and, you know, a great song, and the John Barnes rap, of course, is what so many of us remember. But yeah, I spoke to Peter Hook about that, who was, you know, the bass player in New Order, and they did the recording in Jimmy Page's old studio down in Berkshire. I think they managed to persuade six players to turn up only.
Do you know the six?
Yeah.
Go on, give us.
It was John Barnes, of course, yeah. Beardsley Waddle, Des Walker, Steve McMahon.
Can't imagine Steve McMahon having much of a singing voice, or Peter Beardsley. But it's interesting, a bit of a Liverpool contingent involved in the singing there, and they got a bit of history themselves of singing, so maybe they thought it was going to be some fun.
Yeah, and also what's interesting is Craig Johnson was there as well, because he'd helped to write the Anfield rap 2 years earlier, and Craig Johnson went along with John Barnes, and he contributed some of the lines from the rap, because the rap was only half written going into the studios. So Craig Johnson's there kind of helping to put it all together at the last minute. But yeah, I think Peter, they did all had to have a go at rapping to see who wouldn't be awful. So Peter Beardsley actually did do a rap, and I think very quickly they must have realised that the John Barnes was the only possible
candidate.
There
must be a recording of that somewhere, Peter Beardsley rapping. The book has got all sorts of insight into the social commentary, the different elements, including the music of the time and the influence on the tournament itself. Let's quickly run through to what we all call today's match of my life, which is the West Germany game. So England's route through qualifying, first three group games, as you mentioned, the Republic, Netherlands, Egypt, no one really fancying England at that stage. But Bobby Robson did something remarkable, didn't he, with his tactics and his formation when it got to the Belgium game.
Well, that's right. Bobby Robson, England were, predominantly 4-4-2 team then. Bobby Robson, it was the Holland game actually where he first made the tweak. He played a sweeper system, which, at the time seemed like this great revolutionary thing, an England team suddenly, playing with three at the back. I think it was said that this was sort of player power. I don't think that was necessarily the case. I spoke to Graham Turner, who is a kind of old UEFA journalist. He'd been Terry Venables' translator in Barcelona, and he knew Bobby Robson quite well, and he said that Bobby was very good at speaking to people, hearing people's opinions, but there's no way that he'd have kind of let the players lead the way on that. Don Howe was influential too, so Bobby Robson said, okay, we'll have a sweeper system, which allowed Chris Waddle to kind of play in field a bit and do his stuff. You had Gazza as well there in the midfield. Mark Wright was the sweeper, with Terry Butcher and Des Walker alongside them. And it worked against the Dutch. So from that point on throughout the tournament, they kind of had the two options then. It wasn't always the sweeper system. In fact, in the Cameroon game, it was by switching back to 4-4-2 that they won the game eventually. But sweeper systems in place. Then they played Belgium in the round of 16 and probably get a bit lucky, really.
Right, well, this is where the real story of Italia 90 starts, I think, for many people in terms of their memory. And the 1-0 win over Belgium.
Yeah, Belgium, pretty good team at the time. Enzo Schifo was the famous playmaker. Belgium actually hit the post twice in that game. John Barnes had a volley which was disallowed wrongly. So Barnes was unlucky in that sense. But it goes to extra time. And David Platt, who'd... we'd never actually scored for England at this point. He came on to replace Brian Robson. No, Brian Robson had gone home. Platt didn't start the game, but he came on and scored this sensational volley.
Iconic goal. Yeah, it is now, isn't it?
1 minute from the end, Gazza ball into the box from a free kick, and Platt swiveled and scored. And it was England's first extra time goal since the World Cup final in '66. So we haven't had that many highs, really. So it's no wonder we remember this one.
So we knew something special was on the cards. And by that stage, because I can't remember, were people saying, wow, what a tournament Gazza had even by this stage, or not? Or was this where Gazza was more coming to light?
I think the Dutch game was the one where everyone thought, wow, we've got someone here with Gazza. And the Belgium game, the momentum's really building there. I mean, let's not be wrong here. England, it was a close game against Belgium. And I got to watch the game in kind of FIFA's archives. And at the end of that commentary, after the mic's been switched off, Ron Atkinson turned to Brian Moore and said, we could be the worst team ever to win this, because there was this sense that they'd got lucky. A, there was a bit of luck, and B, there was Gazza, so there was hope.
But more than a bit of luck in the Cameroon game as well, which England won 3-2.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This was in Naples, and the whole crowd's behind the underdogs, Cameroon, who were they were the romantic stories we've mentioned at that World Cup, and England did get lucky. They go 1-0 up through David Platt, but then Cameroon came back and came back very, very strongly. And I think they England was shocked by how good Cameroon were. I mean, Terry Butcher told me a funny story about Howard Wilkinson did the scouting report on Cameroon and basically said, all you've got to do, lads, is turn up. And if you can't beat them, you know, you deserve to go home. And yet, which is an awful underestimation of what Cameroon were about. When England were waiting in the tunnel for that game, the Cameroon team kept them waiting. And suddenly they heard this loud singing and this, you know, these 11 kind of big fellas approaching them in the tunnel. And that was a message saying, you know, we're here and we're here to compete with you. And I went to Cameroon and spoke to some of the players about that. And they, you know, they deliberately did this kind of thing to intimidate their opponents. But, you know,
that sounds like Rome in 84, Liverpool in the tunnel.
Yeah. You could argue that they had a better choice of music than Chris Rea, who knows?
Yeah.
But no, I mean, Cameroon, they've still today, speaking to people like Roger Miller, they have this real sense of frustration about the one that got away. Because at 2-1 up, you know, one of this players, Omen Bierk, I think it was, he was 1-1 against Peter Shilton and he tried a back heel and Shilton saved it. And, you know, they're saying, nowadays when they talk about it, they're saying, you know, if only we'd realised what we were doing, because, you know, we had the World Cup semi-final in our hands. Instead, Lineker won two penalties and England were in the semis, you know, by the skin of their teeth, really.
They had some good players. They also did some dirty fouls as well, including the very first foul of the tournament, I think, which was quite notable, wasn't it, when they played Argentina?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to poor old Benjamin Massing, who he died subsequently, but he was the architect of that, perhaps the worst foul, but maybe the funniest foul as well in World Cup history, where he absolutely wiped out Caniggia, and with so much force that his own boot came off, and he got sent off. But yeah, they committed. I watched that game again. They committed 28 fouls to 9 in that match. They had the biggest foul count in the whole.
28 fouls.
Yeah, to poor old Maradona got, you know, kicked from pillar to post. They were pretty brutal. But they also had, you know, this incredible spontaneous attack in play. So it was kind of Beauty and the Beast with them. They were meaty.
What a colourful lineup when it comes to the semi-final stage then. So you've obviously got Argentina, Italy and England, West Germany. You're talking about four huge nations there, aren't you?
Yeah, and I think for all the criticisms of the World Cup, and, you know, and it did lead to rule changes, which made the game, I suppose, more open and more attacking. In terms of drama, you had two incredible nights of football. You know, the Tuesday night, the first semi in Naples was Italy-Argentina, where Italy, you know, dramatically get toppled by Maradona's Argentina on penalties. You know, Italy, Scalacci scores early on, so it looks like everything's going well. But Argentina came back, equalised through Caniggia's header, and then the penalties. I mean, Italy. I don't know if you want to kind of go in depth on this, but Italy. You know, they'd had this incredible atmosphere in Rome in their previous games, with the whole country was behind them, but then they went to Naples and the crowd wasn't quite with them in the same way because of Maradona. Mm. So I went to see Bergami, who was the captain of that Italy team, and he's a bit sore about the fact that Naples wasn't, you know, completely with them. There was that slightly divided
mixed
feelings.
Emotion.
I mean, I suppose I don't know if there's an equivalent. If just say Uruguay had played England in the World Cup in Liverpool,
and Suarez was playing,
maybe some an equivalent.
Absolutely. And of course, the other semi-final. And let's talk about this as the match of my life today, which was England West Germany, July the 4th, 1990. And just to put a bit of context, obviously it's remembered for Gazza and his tears. There's a brilliant quote, I think it's from Waddle, and he's talking about what was said in the team talk before the game. And he said, Bobby Robson said to Gazza, when you lose the ball, ideally we want you, Gazza, to pick up Lothar Matthäus. And Gazza replied, who's he? Now, is that Gazza joking, or is that Gazza just a childish young footballer who's oblivious to the big names in the game and is just going out there to rip it up?
I think Gazza was just about himself and the football, and that's all that mattered to him. He didn't care who he was up against. Mm. I mean, I went to, while I was researching the book, I went to him talk one evening, and he gave his own take on that story, where Bobby Robson, his recollection of it is Bobby Robson says to him, you know, you've got to be careful against Mateus because, you know, Cameroon had exposed England's midfield. And Bobby Robson said, because Bobby Robson says, you know, Mateus is the best midfielder in the world. And Gazza said, no, Bobby, I'm the best midfielder in the world.
Brilliant.
So, you know, he was playing the football of his life. He's 23 years old. He didn't care about anything apart from, you know, just getting out there and doing his thing.
Ultimately, either story's great, isn't it? They're just superb memories of him, whichever is true or not. The game itself, so West Germany go ahead. England have to come back with a reply in, what, the 80th minute through Lineker?
Yeah, that's right. Although, I mean, England actually played really, really well in that first half. I think they had a corner inside a minute. They were raining in shots on Bodo Ilgner's goal. So they started really well. But then they conceded, really unluckily, a deflected free kick by Andy Bremer just after half time. Then Lineker gets them back into it after, with about 10 minutes left of normal time.
But the defining image is, of course, Gazza crying. So a second foul on
Thomas Berthold,
who you've spoken to. Yeah. Was it a foul?
It's hard to tell, you know. The thing is, Gazza, I mean, I watched some of the other England games, and Gazza did lunge in on players. Mm. He did a very similar thing in the Dutch game, which today might have been a stray red card. I mean, today, nobody would say that's not a booking. He flew in on him after it was out of control. You could say it was a dangerous tackle. Thomas Berthold insists that he was fouled. Thomas Berthold, funnily enough, I met him in Liverpool not so long ago because his daughter's at school in North Wales, and he's a big Anglophile. He insists he got fouled. He said he didn't see Gazza's reaction because he was getting his treatment from the physio. So, and funnily enough, there's a FIFA film of the tournament which shows Gazza goes over to Berthold to sort of pat on the head, consoling. And he actually sticks his finger in Berthold's mouth just to wind him up further, which I don't think that was picked up on at the time amid all the talk about the tears. But yeah, I guess that sums up Gazza's, you know, the cheek of the whole, you know, he was just so mischievous.
What were some of the recollections quickly of that moment where he bursts into tears, he hides half his face with his shirt, Lineker turns to Bobby Robson and does that funny hand gesturing thing?
Yeah, I mean, they just there was a sense that Gazza was going to lose it. I mean, in the commentary, Ron Atkinson says, you know, he's in trouble here. But within 2 or 3 minutes, Gazza is back being Gazza in that match. Funny when you watch it again, and the crowd, the England fans are singing "One Paul Gascoigne," and some people, I mean, we think Gazza lost it, but actually he was within a few minutes he was back playing and. He nearly brought about a late win in that game. And it is interesting, you think a Gazza loses it. About three or four minutes left of extra time, he was really badly fouled by Andy Bremer. And straight away he got up and he shook Bremer's hand. And this is somebody who's just been told, you know, he thinks he won't play in the World Cup final. He was on he's starting to blub. But he's got there was no cynicism about Gazza. You know, it was all very genuine, so he gets up and just wants to get on with it.
And back playing football again. Ultimately, it wasn't to be. England lose on a penalty shootout. Waddle blazes over. But the game is remembered for Paul Gascoigne. Look, there's so much more around that game and other elements of the World Cup. Just give us a quick rundown of some of the people you've spoken to in the book World Emotion.
Yeah, Terry Butcher, Paki Bonner, Tony Cascarino, Kevin Sheedy, David Platt, Brian Robson, Toto Scarlatti, who was the top scorer with Italy, Bergamy. There's about 100 people interviewed in the book. Some of the Cameroonian players, like Roger Miller, players in Romania from the last USSR team. I'm just trying to...
Brilliant memories come flooding back. There's an awful lot in there. Simon, thank you very much indeed for your time. Best of luck with it. The book's out now, World in Motion, the inside story of Italia 90.
Radio City Talk.
Match of my life. Sport's greatest moments.